So, I'm delighted to welcome David Clough today, who has just joined Aberdeen University as Professor of Theology and Applied Sciences up there. The only thing I'm going to say to you about David, there is so much to say, is that he's running a fantastic AHRC-funded project on the Christian ethics of farm animal welfare in partnership with major UK churches, and I just think that's an astonishing project. I don't know if you're going to be talking about, you are talking about, so I will leave that to you. David, thank you.
Thanks so much, Erica. Thanks for the invitation, and more broadly, thanks for all the work you've done in creating and sustaining this network, which is such an important space for interdisciplinary conversation. I don't get to as many events as I like, and it's been a real delight to be here over the last 24 hours and to get to know some of you. I want to spend some time talking to you mostly about this AHRC-funded project on the Christian ethics of farmed animal welfare. We finished an initial 3 years on the project in September 2021. And we're currently in a year of follow-on funding where we're working on impacts in education. So working with school teachers and some church schools and people who are training people for Christian ministry in the UK to think about where some of our findings might find their way into curricula and learning resources. And I appreciate every time I enter an interdisciplinary animal studies space, I appreciate it's unusual for someone working in Christian theology and ethics to be part of the interdisciplinary mix. And so I want to take that seriously and hope to present in a way that helps you to understand what I think we're about in the project and why I think that might be something that's worthwhile. So what we did on this project, as Erica mentioned, was gather from the start a wide range of partners on the project that we were in sustained conversation with. So we had six of the UK churches represented at a national level. So Church of England, for example, was represented by their national rural officer, who spends most of his time out in rural communities talking to farmers. The Roman Catholic Church was represented by Bishop John Arnold, who speaks for bishops in England and Wales on environmental affairs. So really significant buy-in from churches. And then also we had as partners some Christian animals charities, Pasture-Fed Livestock Association, which is a group of farmers providing sort of outdoor access to their animals and certifying that kind of scheme. And then we had an interdisciplinary research team. So we had myself, who works in Christian theology and ethics, a colleague at University of Edinburgh, David Grummett, who is also a Christian theologian and ethicist and sits on DEFRA's Farm Animal Welfare Committee. Margaret Adam, a postdoctoral researcher in Christian theology. But then also Professor Siobhan Mullen, who's a veterinary farm animal welfare specialist, and Paul Hurley, who's a geographer, interdisciplinary researcher at Southampton. And so our aim was to be trying to triangulate between Christian theology and ethics, animal welfare science in relation to farmed animals in particular, and then communities of practice who we hoped would be interested in helping to set the agenda for the research questions for the project, interrogating what it meant to take a Christian approach to the ethics of farmed animal welfare. And then hopefully, and we still hope, might be interested in taking up findings and recommendations from the project and use that to inform the policy of churches. So that was our initial aim. And so in what I say this morning, I'd like to just briefly talk about why we thought focusing on farmed animal welfare was a good idea, help you understand why I think taking a Christian approach to this question might be of interest, not just for Christians, but for people interested in the well-being of animals and animal protection more generally. I want to talk a bit about the foundational concept we decided to work with of animal flourishing, and why that seems appropriate, both in relation to our Christian approach, and also, I think, arguably, of sort of wider interest as a way of framing these questions. And then talk a bit about what we did in relation to discussing the kinds of things farmed animals need to flourish, and then an evaluation of how far current farming systems in the UK enable that flourishing. So we went species by species, asking that kind of question, and then came on to some practical questions. So I hope by the time I've got to the end of what I want to say, you've got a good understanding of the project, and we can have an interesting interdisciplinary conversation about how the position of this in relation to the kinds of things others of you are doing. So let's start with that question of why focus on farmed animal welfare. And the way that I frame this in most of the context where I'm talking about it is to talk about, by the time we got to 1900 in statistics from Vaclav Smil, we'd got to the point where farmed animals outweighed the population of wild land mammals by 3.5 times. And then during the next 100 years, we nearly quadrupled the biomass of domesticated animals, and that was one of the major factors in halving the biomass of wild land mammals. So by the time we get to 2000, the biomass of domesticated animals is 24 times that of wild land mammals. So where I'm trying to sort of make a pitch for the necessity of addressing this issue, my key point is that the magnitude and scope of what we're doing to farmed animals is sort of orders of magnitude in relation to what we're doing in relation to any other animal issue. Unless we address this question soon, the concept of wild animal is going to become an anachronism. In this context, I'd also comment on sort of another issue of why focus on farmed animal welfare. Obviously, there's a debate within the animals movement about animal welfare versus sort of abolition of animal use. Certainly in relation to the kinds of communities that I'm trying to engage in this question, starting with the issue of abolition or not is unlikely to be a good way of getting conversations started. And so I'm convinced, I'm vegan myself, would be very happy to envisage a sort of future beyond our use of animals for food. But I'm absolutely convinced strategically that in terms of engaging the kind of constituencies I need to engage, farmed animal welfare is a really helpful start. And I'm going to talk a bit more about that in relation to discussion of the idea of flourishing. So, second, why take a Christian approach? And there's a range of answers that I'd give to this in an interdisciplinary context. First of all ethics, as an ethicist, I'd want to say that all ethics starts from somewhere. So there is no one ethical view. Whenever we approach ethical questions, we need to identify a particular framework in which to do ethics. And so if you're a reader of Peter Singer, Peter Singer thinks that the way we do ethics is starting from the idea that we should value the preferences of other beings that are sort of similar to us in relevant respects. And so you can get a preference utilitarian approach sort of started with that kind of approach. If you're an animal rights theorist, you start from the position that animals are not property, or animals are subjects of a life and therefore are entitled to a particular degree of respect. I'm a Christian, and so I stand within a particular faith tradition, and that has its own framework of how to think about ethical questions, that is plural and complex in interesting ways. And I'm also an academic working in a discipline of academic Christian theology and ethics, and so both of those provide sort of reasons for me to take a starting point in relation to thinking about these issues in a Christian context. And the way I construct a Christian animal ethics is to think of it as fundamentally pluralistic in its methods. So there are overlaps, I want to argue, with utilitarian concerns, with animal rights concerns, with virtue ethics concerns, with feminist ethics of care concerns, with Martha Nussbaum's sort of capabilities account. And I think a Christian animal ethics can afford to sort of pick and mix between those sort of different of those ethical frameworks in different contexts. But in an interdisciplinary space, I also want to answer this question of why I take a Christian approach to farmed animal welfare in a different way, because it's really striking to me that the kind of history that Kim was narrating for us in relation to the early animal protection movement in Britain is a reminder that the ways that the first legislative efforts in Britain were made to advance animal protection relied significantly on theological argumentation. And then in the later 19th century, in campaigns against vivisection, it's not well remembered in the animals movement that a lot of the anti-vivisection charities were holding meetings which were very similar to Christian revival meetings at the time. So they were singing Christian hymns and there were sermons about human duties towards other animals. And that movement was standing up against the scientific and medical establishment of its day, including figures like Darwin and Huxley, who wanted to resist any restriction on the ability of scientists to experiment on animals. And it was significantly Christian voices, and interestingly, significantly sort of working class Christian voices and women playing a large part in this movement that were standing up against that scientific and medical establishment and saying, no, these we understand for religious reasons that God does not want us to abuse our position of strength in relation to other animals, to exploit them just to extend our own knowledge. And so it seems to me really important to recall that history, you know, which is not present in a kind of Singer-type account of narration of the history of animal protection, and recognise that there is the history of the movement is much more complex than we reckon with. And Kim mentioned briefly this unfortunate period in the history of the RSPCA, where Louis Gompert, who was Jewish, was thrown out of the organization because of its Christian ethos. And I see that as highly problematic, but also an interesting reminder that the RSPCA saw itself as explicitly founded on Christian principles, and only over time began to adopt a more secular outlook. So thinking about a Christian approach to farmed animal welfare seems to me to be a useful point of connection with that history. And then in relation to sort of a contemporary project of what do we need in order to advance questions of animal protection, I think there's been a really significant missing piece in the way the animals movement has engaged a wider public. And organizations like the RSPCA and comparable animal protection movements in the States have lost an ability to speak well to communities of faith. And that means that, say in the US, the animals issue has become positioned on the wrong side of a sort of a secular Christian divide. And Christians have often taken seriously, Peter Singer's analysis that they don't have any significant faith-based reasons for caring about animals. And so another reason I'm interested in taking a Christian approach is to try and make the case to these church partners in the UK, and I'm working on, we've just gathered had a 48-hour meeting with representatives of US churches in Virginia a couple of weeks ago, which I'm hoping will lead to a similar engagement. I want to go in depth in relation to Christian reasons for taking this issue seriously. in the hope that then that might have an impact on the practice of churches, which then might be influential on wider social attitudes. So you may be aware that the Church of England owns about 120,000 acres of agricultural land. And so I'm interested in what would happen if the Church of England adopted recommendations from our policy and then applied that in relation to the work of the church commissioners in how they manage those agricultural tenancies. I'm also interested in how the church manages in its investments. So it has major investments in supermarkets and other food producers. There are bishops in the House of Lords who speak on animal agriculture and other animal welfare issues. And so I'm interested in ways of leveraging that continued influence of Christians in public in the UK, in the United States and elsewhere in order to address these kinds of questions. So maybe if you have questions about that, I'd be very interested. But I think that's my sort of attempt of positioning the kinds of work I'm interested in doing in this kind of interdisciplinary context. So third, I want to address this question of why start with flourishing. As I say, ethics is a diverse enterprise. We could find all kinds of starting points for thinking about the ethics of farmed animal welfare. And in our work on the project, we came to the idea of flourishing. I would say this was a project unlike the way I've done ethics in the past. So right from the start, we had meetings of a partner reference group where we had representatives of most of the 13 institutional partners sitting around the table with members of the research team talking about these questions. And this was a very diverse group. We had someone from Veterinary Christian Welfare who was a veterinary specialist working in industrial dairy production. And then we had some of the Christian Animals campaigning groups who were vegan. And then we had Pasture Fed Livestock Association, and then this National Rural Officer from the Church of England. So had a very diverse group. And I was aware, sort of sitting around at our first partner reference meeting, of how on earth is this going to work? And positioning it as sort of what could we say together on the basis of our, our differences, what would it be possible to say together? And that diversity of partners was really important as to producing a report which had the potential to be receivable in the kinds of church context that we were hoping it might be taken note of. And so this idea of flourishing sort of grew from the kinds of conversations that we had, and we weren't just spending time sitting in rooms right from the start. I thought it was really important to get partners and research team members out to see sites of animal agriculture. And so we took partner representatives out to see how animals were being farmed at different welfare levels. We also visited a slaughterhouse. That was our last site visit immediately before COVID lockdown. And so we had lots of opportunities for conversation on the basis of that sort of sense of what's actually going on farms. And flourishing seemed a really good way of rooting a conversation. So this is, as you'll know, not a concept that's unique to a Christian understanding of animal ethics. It's got roots in sort of Aristotelian ideas of ethics that I think share with a theological understanding of animals, what we could call a teleological approach, the idea that everything that we find around us is goal-oriented. So animals are for something, they have a purpose in the world. And Aristotle had a particular framing of that, and then as taken up in Christian theology by Thomas Aquinas and others, that idea of a teleology, a sort of goal-oriented ness to the life of creatures gets taken into Christian theology. And so that allows us to ask the question, as we look at particular creatures, like the chickens that in sort of broiler systems that I've visited, to look at a particular animal and say, what is this kind of creature for? And one theological answer to that is, what this creature is for is to flourish, and in theological language, to glorify God in their flourishing. And so that would, that's a kind of fundamental theological concept that we used to drive this project. And while it does have that substantive theological content, which we hope is going to be sort of very broadly engaging of a Christian audience, I think there's also really interesting features of taking this approach based on flourishing that are of more a broader interest and applicability. Because I think this idea of flourishing is very helpful as we approach farmed animal welfare, because first of all, it centers the animal themselves and demands that we pay attention to what kind of creature we have before us and what constitutes a good life, a flourishing life for this kind of animal creature. And so it seems to me that it starts in the right place, and in this project that enabled us to draw on Siobhan's expertise in relation to insights from current animal welfare science to say, okay, as we look at chickens and fish and cows and sheep and pigs, what kind of animal do we have before us? And one of Siobhan's points all the way through was we need to recognize that these animals are very close to their wild ancestors in terms of their preferences, despite all of the kind of intensive selective breeding. What a chicken likes is still quite close to what their kind of wild jungle fowl ancestors liked. And when we get to fish, you know, farmed fish are only about 15 generations away from wild ancestors. And so that connection with wild animal flourishing is really important. But also animal welfare science, you know, gives a lot of insights about preferences of domesticated animals, which can then, we can sort of, so in the project, we started with that question, what does a good life for a pig look like, before we then turn to questions of how that fits in relation to farming systems. And so that seems to me a really helpful way of focusing the questions. It's also a very good way of opening conversations, because another thing I learned from Siobhan was that on a previous project where she was engaging dairy farmers with thinking about sort of marginal improvements that could be made to dairy cow welfare, one thing she found a lot of consensus about was farmers were, you know, just whatever kinds of system they were running, you know, organic dairy, calf at foot dairying, or kind of industrial zero grazing systems, the farmers were in broad consensus about what a good life for a cow looked like. You know, the only significant disagreement was how far that was, you know, economically, how far it was economically viable to realize that kind of life, given the kind of economic context we're in. And so what I really like about starting with the question of animal flourishing is it's a position that can open conversations about farmed animal welfare across a really diverse range of stakeholders. And then what I really like about it is I think there's a subtle radicalism in this starting point for the conversation, because while people will have different views about what the cutoff is in terms of what's realistically deliverable in relation to farmed animal flourishing, it seems to me that the trajectory of paying attention to the animal and then asking the question of how far flourishing is realized in a particular context has a really strong trajectory towards thinking about what else we need to do, even beyond any currently, you know, widely available system. So that's another reason I'm really interested in this as a starting point, because it seems to me that it starts us on a path that is really, really helpful in terms of positioning continuing ethical attention. It doesn't just get us to, you know, one stable stopping point. So again, I'd be interested in conversations about flourishing as a starting point for animal ethics. So I now want to turn to thinking a bit about how we realize that, and perhaps give you some examples of how the analysis that we came to both hopefully led to the possibility of some practical recommendations in relation to church practice and practice of other Christian organisations, but also helped to name some of these sort of more radical perspectives. So I'm going to answer these two questions together, species by species, which is what we've done in the framework. So asking species by species, what do particular kinds of animals need to flourish, and how far do current farming systems in the UK enable that flourishing? So we can start with chickens. I decided it was made sense in our framework to order the animals we were considering by number, and I was a little bit surprised to find, even with the kind of astonishing numbers of fish in aquaculture in the UK at the moment, numerically per year, chickens still outnumber fish. And so we wanted to answer the question about what do chickens need to flourish, and as I say, we're drawing on farm animal welfare science to do that. And so Siobhan Mullen, who's now at Trinity Dublin, helped us with these charts about what we could learn from animal welfare science about what chickens need. And so I appreciate not all of this might be visible. By the way, you can find our sort of 60-page PDF framework on the project website, abdn.ac.uk/CEFAW, if you want to have a look at it now or later. And these charts all come from that. But I won't go into detail with all of the species, but it's really striking to me that, so with a starting point at the top box there. So Siobhan writes, well, chickens need to be hatched into a comfortable environment that promotes maternal care and good health, as well as opportunities for pleasure. And I hope you see right at the starting point there, we've got something that's astonishingly radical in relation to thinking about the farming of chickens, because there is no commercial system of farming chickens that fulfills that that basic requirement about access to maternal care. But once you begin to think about what a good life looks like for a chicken, both for mother hens and for chicks, the idea that flourishing should not include maternal care and that kind of intergenerational transmission of knowledge and culture of chickens looks remarkably implausible, I think. You know, it's really hard to say, okay, we could really think about chicken flourishing without paying attention to the bond between a mother hen and her chicks. And then there's really interesting points of contact with specifically Christian insights, because in the New Testament, one story recorded in the Gospels is Jesus weeping over Jerusalem and saying, how many times have I longed to gather you up, Jerusalem, like a mother hen gathers her chicks? So there's a whole history of Christian commentary on that text, including figures in the Reformation like Luther, where Christian theologians are pondering on that text and pondering on their experience of seeing mother hens with their chicks. So Martin Luther sort of comments on seeing mother hens and chicks. And this becomes an image of, you know, divine care for the world. And so you begin to get these really interesting points of contact between Christian scriptural and theological discussion and this kind of completely alien, in one sense, insight from animal welfare science. And then I think, you know, when I talk to Christian audiences, well, you know, what do we make of the fact that this ordinary, everyday reference point for Jesus and for Martin Luther is no longer part of any of the systems that we're currently getting chicken or eggs from? I think that really helps create this sense of disorientation and helps to begin to represent the strangeness of industrial animal agriculture in a Christian context. And so for me, that's an example of the way in which this could be a really helpful way of opening conversations. I've talked to managers of broiler chicken systems. I don't think they would disagree that it would be a good thing for chicks to be able to spend time with their mothers. You know, the kind of conversation I have with them is, just an appeal to amorality. Well, David, you need to realise I only get one penny per bird on this sort of site of 600,000 birds every, 40 days. You know, if there was ways of kind of making money from a different way of raising chickens, that's, I'd be very happy to do that. But this is kind of what we're currently working in. So again, this question of flourishing, I think potentially is a really helpful lever into thinking about a critical approach to what's currently going on. So maternal care, good health. That broiler chicken manager would say to me, "Oh yeah, it's really important to us that the health of the chickens is a priority, because otherwise we can't get productivity. You know, high welfare and high productivity are strongly associated." So maybe that's less sort of radical approach. But opportunities for pleasure, again, it's really hard to make the case that you could have an idea of animal flourishing that didn't include opportunities for pleasure. But that's pretty much absent in that kind of broiler chicken production, where chickens are, designed to be expending calories only on sort of eating and resting in order to promote the highest possible growth rates and feed conversion ratios and so on. And so you can see that already, that first box gives us a way of saying, sort of red tractor broiler chicken systems are not going to represent good opportunities for flourishing. So Siobhan then goes on to say, rearing in stable social groups, not a factor in most animal agriculture at the moment. In a stimulating environment that provides a choice of pleasurable opportunities and space to play. Then welfare at slaughter. Back looking at breeding questions, birds retained for laying are kept in small social groups, have opportunities for, we've got a typo there, that's no good, have opportunities for nest building, and other opportunities are for pleasure available, such as dust bathing, which again is not possible, as in most commercial systems. So we've got this starting point of thinking about what it means for chickens to flourish, and then that gives us an evaluative framework for thinking about what's possible or how to assess what's currently going on. So within the project, we had a slight issue, went to and fro a bit about how to represent our evaluation of systems. So we could have categorized, and we do discuss different kinds of systems issues, but we realized insofar as we wanted to have an impact on policy, we needed a sort of simple evaluation system that was potentially recognizable to kind of institutional caterers or people shopping in a supermarket. So in the end, we decided to go with an evaluation of certification systems rather than systems of raising animals in a way that could be recognizable for consumers. Again, all these tables are in our framework. And so in these tables, we just kind of summarized some of the issues that we had identified as relevant to the flourishing of each species of animals. And then we lined up sort of major certification schemes insofar as how far they allowed that kind of flourishing. And so as you're probably aware, a lot of consumers see things like a lion badge on eggs or red tractor on animal products and think that that represents some assurance of good animal welfare. And so one of the things that we're really keen to do through the project in education is to use these kinds of charts to emphasize how little beyond a sort of bare legal UK minimum is represented by those sort of basic assurance schemes. And so you can see, you know, helpfully we've got a sort of line of red crosses down in relation to lion eggs. And then we wanted to pay attention to what changes in the sort of next rung and so of welfare. And so we looked at RSPCA Assured as a kind of mediating middle position, but wanted to clearly represent what is required within those schemes and what is not addressed. And so RSPCA Assured, you know, it was new to me to be attending to the detail of beak trimming is still allowed in under that scheme. There's no attention to group size, there's no attention to the culling of male chicks in breeding of laying hens. And then we're really interested in pointing to the ways in which even the highest certification standards, which in most cases are Soil Association Organic at the moment, do not address issues that we consider to be significant in relation to flourishing. So in the case of chickens farmed for eggs, the culling of male chicks, and this idea of rearing chicks with mother hens. And I remember a moment where I was encountering for the first time the fact, you know, reading through Soil Association Organic Standards for Egg Production, and I was just a bit confused to find no reference to culling of male chicks at all. And in my naivety, I phoned up the Soil Association and said, sorry, I must be missing something, but I can't find any reference to this issue of culling of male chicks. And they said, no, that's not something we've been able to introduce into our standards. So having spent some time in sort of working in the field, that was still something of a surprise to me. And so I hope that presenting this to a broad audience will be a really useful educative tool about what is present and not present in some of these certification schemes. And then we do a similar table in relation to chickens farmed for meat, highlighting this issue of maternal care for chicks alongside other issues. It was really important for me and for some of our partners to make sure we were including fish among the farmed animal species that we were addressing. So we sort of tackle questions about in contemporary animal welfare science of sentience of fish. And again, another surprise to me in the project was talking to people, veterinarians working with Scottish aquaculture, and to find how far fish were just a completely different case in terms of protections than any other farmed species. So you don't need a vet present when you're handling fish. You don't need a vet in order to give sort of medication to fish. There's all kinds of really basic protections that are missing from fish as a farmed species. And this is the kind of view that spoiled recent holidays in the Outer Hebrides for me after realizing what was going on in these sea cages. So the striking thing for me in relation to doing this kind of table in relation to salmon was first of all paying attention to the idea of salmon as a migratory species, as something specific to thinking about what it might mean for salmon to flourish. And so the idea that you've got this astonishingly complicated life of sort of migration between fresh and salt water and migrations over hundreds of miles, and then you're taking that kind of animal and keeping them in sort of bare freshwater on land pens or these sea cages where they've got sort of no opportunity for movement of any distance. That's again another kind of light bulb moment for me in terms of what happens when you start thinking about the flourishing of animals first and then think about what it means to keep them in these kinds of systems. Again, striking to me, even in the Soil Association Organic standards, which are fairly limited in terms of how far they're actually in use. There's absolutely no regulation about environmental enrichment. And so despite, you know, animal welfare science beginning to show that that's something that fish care about, unsurprisingly, there's no regard to that in relation to any of the standards about how you farm salmon. And so it's another indicator of how far animal protection and animal welfare is in relation to fish, how far behind that is in relation to other species. And so we're most negative of any of the species we look at, we're most negative in relation to fish, asking the question about whether there's any way of giving an account of flourishing of fish like salmon in an agriculture context. I'm not going to go into as much detail in relation to other species, but we do the same kind of work in relation to the other major species of farmed animals. In relation to sheep, the striking feature for me in that top box from Siobhan is no castration or tail docking, as you know, fundamental to flourishing. So Siobhan was insistent, despite a lot of the farmers that we were talking to, that both of those procedures were very painful, gave rise to chronic pain for sheep, and also had an impact on just their ability to live beyond those procedures. And then it's really striking that even in the organic and pasture for life standards, there's no attention at all to either of those mutilations. So again, I think that's really helpful sort of fruits from starting with this idea about animal flourishing and then turning to the question of what current certification systems require. Because we had Siobhan on the project, I got to see industrial pig production for the first time. I hadn't been able to get access to that previously, and that was definitely the most traumatic site visit of any that we made. And the contrast between that and a visit to this organic pig farm, this is my photo, was extraordinary. And so again, we're paying attention to what pigs need to flourish, including attention to mutilations, maternal care, and in relation to sows, the opportunity to build a nest. Many of you may be familiar with these amazing studies at Edinburgh, where Woodgush and team took pigs from intensive farming context and gave them access to parkland, and found that they adopted a behavioural repertoire very similar to that of wild boar, and had particular friendships, very territorial. Sows would go off about a half a kilometre away from the rest of the pigs to build an elaborate nest, and would only allow their best friends sort of within that nest. So really astonishing set of behaviours still present despite sort of multi-generational selective breeding within intensive context. So again, another example of the proximity of what constitutes flourishing of domesticated pigs to their wild ancestors. And so we do, and so one of the findings of that study is that pigs spend over 50% of their active time rooting in the earth. They've got this astonishingly sensitive snouts that they do that with, and of course in this kind of industrial system, that kind of behaviour is just entirely impossible. And you can see that all the kind of scratches on the tail docked pigs that result from this astonishingly impoverished environment. So again, we do that same kind of table there. And then similar questions in relation to flourishing of cattle. We just had the first meeting of RE teachers on this follow-up impact project last week, and took them to an all-year-round housed dairy herd just south of Chester. And we were looking at calves that had been taken away from their mothers in sort of and kept in this kind of hutch in that system. And you may have seen the Panorama documentary recently. The dairy farmer that we were visiting was sort of quite anxious about whether or not it was a good idea to host a visit fairly soon after that Panorama documentary that had highlighted maternal care as a key welfare issue, and taking away calves from mothers as, you know, a key challenge. And again, I think it's that kind of highlighting that kind of issue rather than the kind of sporadic abuse type of thing, which has the potential to be really radical in getting people to rethink basic questions about the farming of animals. And so I think it's sort of this flourishing approach helps get a grip on some of those really basic questions about what a good life for animals consists in that raise important criticisms. So we, you know, have that table on cattle farm for milk and for beef. Again, mutilations like castration and disbudding of horns, not prohibited even in the highest welfare standards. So I've given you a quick run through the way we've approached these questions. So then we have, at the end, we have conclusions and recommendations. None of these will be mind-blowing to you. We talk about the need to reduce consumption of animal products. Even if you're only focused on animal welfare, there's no way to achieve substantial increases in animal welfare without substantial reductions in consumption. But then, of course, once you take into effect climate issues and other environmental issues, human health, impact on wild animals and so on, that case for reduction becomes even more important. And then we talk about sourcing animal products from farming systems that promote the flourishing of farmed animals. And more specifically, we say churches and Christian organizations ought to be seeking to move away from systems that we evaluate as poor and towards a sort of better and best. And then beyond that, look for producers that are paying attention to some of the additional welfare issues that we identify with. So as I say, you can find that document on our project website if you're interested. And there's a few videos and things that we've produced to go alongside that. And we're continuing to engage with UK churches and beginning to engage in the US and elsewhere with taking this kind of thinking about animal welfare in a Christian context out to churches and other Christian organisations in order to seek to achieve changes in understanding and policy. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.